back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Another episode where we're focusing right here, right now, in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of summer, some things that can be done. First, before we get to that, because almost all these things can be done with reading, by the way, as well, Taharka Ice Cream, also made in Baltimore. I got the Wake and Bake here, the coffee ice cream with the fudge swirl and chunks of fudge brownies. Goes great with a book, and made in Baltimore. Our friends at Taharka, big love for them as I pour through some Honey Graham ice cream, as well as our friends at State Fair over in Catonsville, the chicken, the waffles, it's all there for you. I have not had the shrimp and grits during COVID. I will be doing that soon under the tented outdoor area right across the street, El Guapo, new Mexican restaurant. I have warned Evan Brown, and I'll have him on the program this week. I'm going to get the first chip and dip and first guacamole that they're going to have there on Frederick Road. Don, tell everybody what's going on in Fadley's, because it is the 4th of July. I am wearing the 4th of July Fadley's Crab 2.2 million video shirt here.
Well, Fadley's continues to ship their great crab cakes all over the United States. Incredible. They're open for curbside. Great things happening at Fadley's. And, of course, we're very excited that Fadley's, in addition to their historic Lexington Market location, are heading to Catonsville, opening up an incredible venue, bringing the market to Catonsville. And it will include what I think will become one of the most in-demand event spaces in the entire state. An absolutely spectacular historic building. So, as you said, great things happening. Mulwer and Gary, Jeff Mulwer selling homes. Lots happening out there, Nestor, our good friends at Center Maryland. And I don't know that you've been more excited about any guest than our next guest.
Yeah, it's been a little while. I mean, you know, I love politicians and I love policy and education and crime and authors and all that. But at heart, Don, I wrote a big blog recently about at heart, I am a writer, right? Like, it's my first skill. It's the first thing I did as a newspaper writer and writing books. And we are just delighted to have the CEO of Enoch Pratt Free Library right here in Baltimore on the backside of another incredible video with Wes Moore. Coming on and telling his stories. We've had him on Baltimore Positive. We welcome Heidi Daniel from Michigan, from Ohio, but now in Highland Town with Frank Zappa and helping children read and people read. And it is really a pleasure to have you on. I know you have a big role here, but Don and I are very, very fond of books and library and reading and stuff.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. So any friend of libraries and books is a friend of mine.
All right, so I'm going to tell the worst story you've heard, you know, recently, because it leads to reading, and it really led to Baltimore Positive. I wrote a book on the Ravens winning a championship 7 years ago. I know you were in Youngstown. I'm sure that, you know.
Actually, I was in Houston.
You were, okay.
Oh, no, I would have been in Youngstown.
Okay,
right,
so between, like, Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh, you're right there in the old, you know, AFC North triangle. So I write this book, and, you know, the whole city's crazy. There's parades. Everyone loves the Ravens. It's a great story with Ray Lewis and Ed Riedel. So I write this 500-page book with all the background, stuff that I didn't even know, being a sports writer covering the team. And the whole time, Don's proofing it. And I said, Don, man, I'm telling you, stories can be great, great. I got down to Ocean City. There were 10,000 Ravens fans Father's Day week, first week of June, and I've got the books out in the heat. And all the Ravens fans came by me, one by one by one. I had stacks of books. I'm ready to sign them. $20, you know. These people spend thousands of dollars going to the Super Bowl. And they come by and they say, I don't read no books. I ain't read no books in 20 years. I ain't got no pictures in it. And I came back from the beach, and Don, you remember this phone call, and I said, civilization as we know it is
I do is
falling.
But
I mean,
but Heidi is here to tell us why.
I know, but this
to an end.
This is why I stopped talking about sports so much, because we need people reading out there, Heidi. So I want to give you some ideas. Tell me first and foremost what you're doing in the middle of this, because it's so hard for people to gather, and libraries are a place for people to kind of come and be together sort of kind of quietly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for libraries, public libraries across the U.S., and for us in particular here at the Pratt, it's been particularly difficult to navigate how we play the central role that we play in our city during a time when we can't do what we naturally do, which is bring people together for the free exchange of ideas. You know, prior to COVID-19, prior to the shutdown, we were having events in our newly renovated central library. You know, every week we were having an event with 1,000 people. It could be, we had Mae Jemison, we had Spike Lee, we had, just huge names coming in every night. And we would be packing the rafters, and it was so wonderful because you'd see these groups of people come in and talk to each other, and we had David Brooks, and we did an event with Thread, and the people had conversations, and they would look each other in the eye, and you would watch these new sort of groups of community form, and then groups would disperse, and then they'd collect over here in another in a slightly different configured group, and just really talk to one another as people and have this idea. You'd laugh together at, you know, something that an author said at Colson Whitehead or at Spike Lee. People would be, you know, shocked or surprised by an idea, and you'd see people look at each other and talking, and so for us to then have to shut all of that down and walk away from it felt particularly cruel in that moment. It felt just really shocking to say, we're going to close. We'd had an event earlier in the week, the week we decided to close. It had been a smaller event with Thomas Friedman, and we were just thinking, like, wow, we're not going to be doing this for months. So we had to really quickly pivot and figure out how we were going to try to adjust.
There are no small events with Thomas Friedman in my life, by the way.
For us, it was smaller.
He's only won 3 Pulitzers, for crying out loud.
Yeah, like, you know, just a tiny thing with Thomas Friedman. No, it was, we've had some huge names, great thinkers. And, you know, we have a couple of series, our Brown Lecture Series, our Hackerman Best and Next, that are really focused on bringing major thought leaders to the city of Baltimore. And so we've been doing that. But the Thomas Friedman event was pretty small in attendance, simply because it was right at the start when people were going, wait a minute, are we supposed to be gathering in the groups? Could we, you know, we were trying to space out chairs, and you were still trying to figure out what is this going to mean for us? And then I think it was later that week that we all started to go, like, listen, we're not going to be able to allow the public in our buildings at this rate any longer. So, it was probably about 150 people that were there. And now when you think about that, it seems like, wow, my God, we had 150 people in this room together. You know, I instantly start to feel panicky about the fact that, you know, that many people would gather. But at the time, it still was fine. And so for us to then walk away from that was hard. So we went back on as our team and said, what are we going to do to keep all of our services running? So we had to really quickly pivot to prioritizing e-resources. We reached out to Baltimore City Public Schools and said, what are you guys going to need for parents and teachers to have online? Our collection access chief went online and, just contacted all of her sources. And we got a lot of new e-resources up really quickly so that we could have tutoring resources for kids at home, read aloud books for kids to follow along and read along with them, resources that connected directly to the curriculum for the city schools, so some Scholastic resources were added. And then we started adding job resources pretty quickly. We added a new resource that connected you with a live career counselor, someone who could help you practice interviews, someone who could help you with a job search. And our staff pivoted to doing online help with unemployment applications. We switched to a telephone reference service so people could still call in and we could return their call and walk them through it. We started doing online tech help. And then
much more than checking out a book, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really, right?
So that's what public libraries are today, right? Like, we definitely still check out books, and that's a really important part of what we do, but there's so much more at the Pratt when we're open during normal times. You know, we have our social workers here helping people navigate, you know, difficulties that may be keeping them from, steady housing, steady employment. All of that is linked together. So our social workers are here to really help people through those types of situations, and our partnership with Maryland Legal Aid helps people with civil legal issues that might be having, expungements that they can do, because all of that, it all ties together, right? So it's the reading, it's the books, it's the knowledge, but it's also about all of the other things you need in life so that you can focus on things like reading a book, right? So we've really become the center of the community for everything. So people come into us and say, I need a job, or I need assistance with filling out an application.
Do people come in and just say, I can't read? Does that happen every day?
So yeah, not really. There's a lot of stigma around it. So,
sure,
right,
but I figure that might be a safe space. That may be the one place you walk in and say, I can't read, and a librarian would put you in the right direction there,
maybe more so than another place. It does happen to some degree. And we actually have a great story of the first year we were doing our social worker program. This was about two, it was right after I came, so close to 3 years ago now. And we had a social worker who had a customer do just that, say, like, I can't read. He said it to the librarians. The librarians connected him with the social worker, and they got him set up, and he came back in like a couple months later and told us, I read this bill today, and it's the first time I've been able to read my bill.
Oof.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot happening on a daily basis. Like, I think there's a lot of study around the role of the public library in our society as a whole. And in urban libraries, in urban settings in particular, listen, we're a lot of things. We're the safety net for a lot of people. We're the thing that keeps people from falling completely to the ground. For some folks, we're what normalizes some abnormal situations for them. We were doing an interview with Good Morning America, and this didn't make the cut onto the Good Morning America segment. You know, they filmed for like 3 days, and then you get like a 30-second clip. But there was a customer who just happened to walk by and said, I was homeless, and I came here with my daughter all the time to give her a sense of normalcy so she could be in the children's area and be interacting in a way that was totally normal with the staff and with the collection and with other kids in the space. And the dad was looking for jobs and for houses, and the staff helped him with that, and he's back on his feet. And we were that sense of normalcy for him. And then we also have, you know, moms of, you know, middle-class moms coming in with their kids for story time, you know, just looking to educate them before they get to kindergarten, getting them pre-K ready. So we might have doctoral students coming in to do research in our Maryland room or in one of our branches. So really, one of the great things that we do that we can't do during COVID-19 is bring all of these different types of people together in this one space and treat them all as valuable human beings. And hopefully they see each other in that same way while they're here in our space. So, you know, the library plays this like sort of really pivotal role of bringing us all together around education and knowledge. And so it's a really important civic space for our communities.
Heidi Daniel is the CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. I've used it many times. And give a high five to Frank Zappa when I'm over at G&A Coney Island Hot Dog as well. Don, she said the T word. She said thread somewhere in there. I know that got
me. Oh, my God. Well, you know, Heidi, as Nestor knows, one of our favorite guests and without a doubt favorite organizations in all of Baltimore is Thread, led by Sarah Heminger, who we just think is a force of nature. Talk a little bit about your work with Thread, because we love that group.
Yeah, so we had a really great event with them right before we closed, where we had Dee Watkins and David Brooks on stage together discussing, you know, how we talk to one another in this sort of United States we find ourselves in that's sort of a separated United States, how we help each other, what we owe one another, how we help each other through different circumstances in life, how we can support our youth regardless of where they are. So it was a really, really interesting event that really brought a lot of different types of people together into our space to have this important conversation. And that was just just a couple of months before COVID happened and we closed down. So that's as far as our partnership has gotten, but certainly it's one of the organizations that we hope we can, you know, continue to support.
So I should tell you,
as you said, everything becomes a blur now, Heidi, but in the recesses of my mind, I think I had in my sense that I was on my way. I was very excited to head down to the Pratt to hear John Meacham, and then COVID hit, and I think that was canceled as a result of it. Something.
Yeah, so
you know.
The John Meacham was actually the Thomas Friedman event. So John Meacham ended up having he had a conflict at the last minute with his family. And so Thomas Friedman stepped in for him. And we are going to have John Meacham again back at a later date.
Well, Don will be there.
I will jump on and get a ticket and be there because I love Meacham. Heidi, when I listen to you talk, a couple of thoughts. Is this ain't my grandmother's library.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't, when, you know, as a little boy walking around Catonsville who got turned on to reading by reading an author by the name of John R. Tunis, who wrote little sports books, you know, that the nuns were saying, you got to read. And luckily, I found this guy named John R. Tunis who wrote books like The Kids from Tompkinsville and other things. And I thought, all right, This is about baseball. I can do this. So to me, that was my understanding of libraries. Yeah. This is very different. So the question is, can you talk a little bit about how libraries have evolved and why they evolved? And also, how does a little Heidi, 8-year-old Heidi, growing up in Michigan, say, I want to be a librarian? You know, it's not a career choice that everyone makes.
Yeah, so I think that's all sort of tied together. I don't know the 8-year-old. I think 8-year-old Heidi would have told you she wanted to be like both a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader and a scientist. So, you know, I don't know. I can't say that I was.
And my guess is mom and dad said, Heidi, we'll go with the scientist.
Right. Well, yeah. So interestingly, my connection to libraries is really personal. I was raised in Michigan. I'm the only adopted child of a factory worker who had an eighth grade education. And my mom stayed at home off and on. She was a housekeeper. She worked in the school cafeteria. You know, she wanted to really be involved in raising me, but, you know, not a lot of formal education. And, you know, they were real working class people, and college was not like a given in my household. But when my parents adopted me, they made this commitment that they wanted me to have, you know, an education. They wanted me to be well educated. And to them, that meant, well, she should love to read. And if she loves to read, she'll be well educated. So I can't remember a time when my parents didn't give me little golden books, take me to the public library. You know, going to the public library was this sort of experience of walking into a place where I could have anything because there, you know, nobody was going to tell me, like, we can't afford that. Wait, you know, wait, it's a payday or that's not, you know, maybe in a few months. You know, I mean, there was just a, like, here, you can take it home with you. That's fine. And so for me, it was this, like, great place of freedom. And I really devoured, like, anything and everything I could get my hands on, maybe because I was an only child and didn't have anyone else to talk to. It makes you, like, a little weird, I guess. And so
did you pay any fines? I mean, be honest with me. Did you keep a few too late?
I probably, but you know, we eliminated fines here, and maybe that's why.
So. You did that right away, Heidi. Yeah. Right? It was one of the first things you did.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it was the first year I was here. It was something that I had looked into before I even interviewed for the Pratt, was sort of what were things that I could do. And I needed to get to know the community, but that one had like a really solid equity and business sense to me. So it was one of the first things we did was eliminate fines.
See, we didn't have a
to me
library
again about the evolution.
Yeah.
And that's when I can't see Joe, so we end up talking over. But talk about how libraries have evolved from that one that I went to as a little kid where I learned the Dewey Decimal System and I got to take out these books about little kids playing baseball to where it is now, the true center of the community.
Yeah, so when I started in libraries, it was sort of coincidental. I started working in libraries in an outreach capacity, and I started in Oklahoma City, and then I spent a good portion of my career actually in Houston, where I was in charge of programming. And so when I started, I decided to go back and get my master's because I got a promotion that kind of required that I finish my master's in library studies. So I did that, and went to work for Houston Public in their programming department, and I had started in an outreach department in Oklahoma City. And so for me, my connection to libraries came from creating community spaces, like from the beginning. That's what I was involved in. And when I started in libraries, what was happening was computers were introduced and people were kind of freaking out about how will this impact our service model, right? Because now will people, I feel like I've been hearing this for my entire career, which is about a 20-year career. And I think for that whole time, people have been saying, wow, you're going to lose libraries altogether because no one's going to read anymore and there's going to be all this technology and technology is going to make you completely irrelevant. And I've been hearing that for 20 years and I still hear it from people. People will say, well, everything I need is right here on my phone. And I'm like, well, then I feel really bad for you because you're missing out on a lot of the world. One, and then two, there's a lot of people who don't have that privilege that you just talked about, right? They don't have everything that they need right at the fingertips on their phone because they don't have solid broadband Wi-Fi access to connect their devices to, and they can't afford an expensive data plan. So from the beginning, I think I had this really unique perspective on libraries of community spaces and also spaces that were supposed to be looking at larger societal issues like the digital divide. And all of that, to me, tied into libraries as a place of access, which is what books were always about. We were providing books because that's how you accessed information. That's how you accessed knowledge. That's how you accessed enrichment and stories and storytelling. And now there's a lot of ways to access that, and the library's job is to evolve and adapt and find and give you access to all the different ways you can get information and resources.
You know, my background, I didn't have a library in my neighborhood. Don knows where I grew up over by East Point Mall. I mean, I felt like I had everything on the bus line, except the library was difficult to access. We had a bookmobile. We had a nice library at my elementary school. But, like, going to the library was, like a special thing for me. You know, I had to get a ride, and I wanted to stay all day, and I wanted to check out the microfiche from the Baltimore Sun from the 1950s to look up, like, box scores and stuff. Right, Don?
Yeah,
I mean, it all goes back to sports, right? And for me, I couldn't walk, and it wasn't there every day, yet I loved reading and would check out from the time I was a kid, Curious George books and stuff like that. But I saw 22. Is that still the right number? They're 22 in the city. Mm-hmm. And how far away, for people in the city and what you do specifically, for it to be a neighborhood place or a place that everyone should know or have a card or have been in lately or this year for something or another, Wi-Fi or anything it is, what's the reality of when, if you open back up, that funding and all of those things that are so integral for the city and what Brandon Scott's about to interact mm-hmm. with, that it is in a neighborhood and can be accessed? Because, I mean, I'm going back 30, 40 years. I would think it's probably no different. And my son lives in my parents' house now, that you have to have kind of a car to get to the library from where we live or lived. But in the city, you know, it feels like people are a little bit more mobile. I live downtown. I'm 8 blocks from you. I walk by you all the time, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think that we, you know, as a newcomer to Baltimore, it's one of the things that has sort of amazed me is just what a complete city of neighborhoods Baltimore is. And I understand that. And I, you know, of course, before I even moved here, read Not in My Neighborhood and, you know, sort of delved into the redlining history in Baltimore so that I could really try to understand the
city. He's on the show later today, by the way. So thank you.
great. So we are a city of neighborhoods, and I think sometimes the challenge is if there's not a library directly in your neighborhood, getting to the one that's closest to you. I think the city is somewhat fortunate in that most of our libraries are probably within a couple of miles of each other, 2 or 3 miles, but there can be a lot of barriers that separate neighborhoods that can prevent people from getting to the library if they don't live within a certain circumference of one. So, you know, we had been talking about a new library in Park Heights when I first got here. We're still looking for the funding for that. The reality is the funding and maintenance of our infrastructure is a major cost and has to be constantly invested in and upgraded, and some of our branches really could use upgrades, and we're hoping to be able to accomplish that through combinations of working through, obviously our public funding, but also some private funding like we did here at Central, and we're hoping that that will be a model we can replicate out into branches as well. It's 22 branches is a lot for funding and infrastructure. It's public funding essentially keeps our lights on and our doors open, and then our private funding pays for all of the stuff that we do that people really come to see and do and enjoy. So all of our speaker series, all of our programs. Right now we're doing virtual camps for teens and kids all summer long. That's all paid for through private funding. And, our public funding has to really be stretched to cover all 22 of our buildings. So, of course, we'd like to be able to be more present in all of our different neighborhoods, but it's probably not a reality that we'll be able to build a lot of new libraries. I would like to see us look in the future into how we partner with other agencies and entities to create satellite libraries in rec centers maybe, even hospitals or community health centers. I think there's a lot of different models that are happening throughout the U.S. There's some great examples of libraries and public housing. And so I think we're going to have to think about how we physically reach people in new ways other than just build a new standalone solo library. And that's something I'm really interested in exploring as we move forward here. But we do very carefully think about, is this library on a bus line? What are the challenges of getting here? Do someone have to cross a major you know, highway to get across here. So, you know, there's a lot of considerations that goes into mapping out where our locations are and where they should be. A lot of our buildings are historic and have been in neighborhoods for a long time, and it's probably a good idea to look at, are they still in the right place coming up in the future? So that's something we're interested in doing as a, you know, sort of facilities planning piece as well. But we are community anchors. We do have our mobile outreach. So our mobile units go out to different neighborhoods. We're about to start deploying them in July as community Wi-Fi hotspots. So they'll go out to public places, and people will be able to connect up to 60 devices to them so that we can sort of help bridge that gap. Because we have all this great virtual programming right now, but if you don't have internet connection, you can't partake in it. So we're looking at ways that we bridge that gap through different methods. So we're loaning hotspots. We're sending our mobile units out as hotspots. And we're really thinking through partnerships where we might be able to create greater connectivity throughout the city. We do have drive-in Wi-Fi, too, at 8 of our locations.
PrattLibrary.org. I want to make sure I get that out for everybody with Wi-Fi. Go ahead, Don.
Say that again.
PrattLibrary.org is the way to find them. And, you know, I want to throw something in it. Don, you'll appreciate this. One of my author buddies, sports author buddies, actually the director of natural history and sustainability out in Oakland, wrote a baseball book called The Wax Pack. He opened up a pack of baseball cards and then went out across the country and interviewed. He's on the New York Times bestseller list. He reached to me a week and a half ago and said, I want to do like an online thing in a bookstore. And I said, well, I wonder if Enoch Pratt's doing that sort of virtual thing. I know you did something with Wes Moore. I want to give you a little bit of oxygen on this, Heidi, to talk about the virtual stuff you are doing when I do go out. And I'm on your website right now, prattlibrary.org. There's just a bunch of stuff you guys do here online that I don't physically have to, you know, come on up to Cathedral Street and see you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go online and look. We do have our July-August compass up now, too, and that's out in print and online as well. But we have everything from these virtual camps for teens that can be maker camps, technology camps, comedy camps. We have a schedule every day of story times. We have live music. We have live author events. Like you mentioned, Wes Moore, we recently had.
Oh, you got yoga events here. That's right down. That's on my alley, Heidi.
Yoga, that's right. And we are also, we have book clubs, and we have Workforce Wednesday. We're still doing a lot of our workforce work that we did in our buildings, but now we're doing it online. So you can go online on Wednesdays and get help with your job search, writing resumes, cover letters, interview strategies, all of it. We also have some larger name authors coming up this year. We're finalizing that schedule now. And beginning in the fall, a lot of those are going to end up being virtual. So it'll be a lot like the Wes Moore event where we'll have our speakers and we'll be able to have people watching from Zoom and streaming live onto Facebook, and you know, you'll be able to see the speakers and the panelists. So, you know, we're excited to be able to continue to offer this stuff virtually as we get our doors reopened. We are doing sidewalk service right now at 8 of our locations, and starting July 6th, that'll be 12 locations that you'll be able to pick up your materials through a contactless curbside or sidewalk pickup. And we're hopefully looking at starting, you know, as we progress here to have some public entering the building, assuming that health metrics stay, you know, stable and that we're able to retrofit our buildings for some social distancing.
Well, Heidi, it's so exciting. I've just got a couple of quick questions that you've been very gracious with your time. But listening to you talk and your enthusiasm, it's exactly why we started Baltimore Positive, why we believe in this city, and we believe this city's future is bright. Your predecessor, I've had the opportunity in life. I've followed people who weren't great leaders, and I followed people who were phenomenal leaders. It's always a little easier to follow someone who wasn't great because you come in and then, you know, you get recognized right away. You followed a legend in Carla Hayden, and and she was there 23 years. You've been there three. So in 20 years, when you head to the Library of Congress with this great legacy behind you, what does the Pratt look like in 20 years under Heidi Daniels' leadership? Where we come back in 2040, talk to us about what the Pratt looks like.
Sure, absolutely. First, I do want to say I love following a great, amazing, strong female African-American leader like Carla Hayden. It's been my honor and pleasure, and she's like a wonderful, gracious, lovely person who led a great organization. So hopefully, as we continue in 20 years, you know, my predecessor saying the same thing. But I hope, you know, one thing that's really important to me is really drilling down. We have this gorgeous central library that we've renovated, but I'd love to like really drill down into what we're doing in our communities and our neighborhoods. And I think advancing the vision of neighborhood library services is going to be key for us. So taking that concept of the community anchor and figuring out how we continue to evolve it. Listen, we have to be active players in the city of Baltimore. I live in the city. My family is growing up here. I have two kids. We love living here, and I want to join forces with, you know, Brandon Scott, the incoming mayor, all of the people that are working to make Baltimore a better city, and really push that agenda forward. We need opportunities for our youth. We have youth coming into our libraries every day, and we want to continue growing them, and not just offering them entertainment, but really creating the next generation of critical thinkers, great leaders, exposing them to science and, you know, great thought leaders and people who are inventing and creating and moving the field forward. We want to see them exposed to all of this. We want to see our neighborhood branches continuing to have the social workers and the lawyers and all of those services that people need. Listen, when you interview people, libraries are one of the most trusted institutions throughout the country, and we want to continue that. So when I leave, I want people to say, you know what, there's no organization that I trust as much as I trust the Pratt to give me good information, to help me get moving forward on my journey, to help me get to what I need in life and to move the city of Baltimore forward with all of the partners. I mean, we can't do it alone, obviously. We're just a library, but we could do a lot with all of our partners in moving the city forward. And I really hope that when I leave in 20 years, that's what we've done.
Well, the place is so cool. It's got Nestor, a Frank Zappa statue, you know? So, I mean, it can't be better than that, right?
Right, yeah.
Nestor, I know you'd like to be inspired. How'd this work out for you?
This worked out great. The only problem is I can't come up and visit her. I got to stay 6 feet away. I can't elbow bump and do all that.
That's right.
You did mention something that, you know, I would think is of a grave concern for everybody. It's just the reopening part of, like, getting human beings in, that it's going to be different when you reopen, right? And I think every place that's going to open, we've talked to so many of the museums, so many of, you know, the aquariums and different places in town that really want to have people in, especially this time of the year. You're as significant as any of them. But what have you learned about, and I've only been a few times I've had my temperature taken. I haven't been out a whole lot, you know, to a lot of places. I was in crazy North Carolina last week when nobody's wearing a mask, so we came home from that. But I know when things open, it's going to be a struggle for everyone to get used to whatever the new normal is from just literally opening the doors and being clean, being safe.
Yeah, absolutely. So keeping our buildings clean is a major issue for us. You know, making sure we have enough facility staff to help keep us clean. Our first priority is to keep our customers and our staff clean, you know, safe, I mean, and our buildings clean so that they are safe. So, you know, we want everyone to be following safe protocols. So when we are able to open on what we assume will be an appointment-based basis, because we'll have limited capacity, we will be requiring masks. We will probably be doing temperature checks. We're not sure on that yet. We're, you know, working through some policy issues with the city. So it'll definitely look different. You won't just be able to walk in the front doors, at least not right away. We're having to look at our building spaces right now. We're moving things around. So computer capacity is going to be limited because you can't sit right next to each other any longer and work on the computers. We got to distance people. In a space that was meant to bring people together, it's now looking at it and saying, how do we keep people here but separate? So, you know, we're moving our furniture around. We're looking at our staff spaces because a lot of those are communal spaces. How do we keep them separate as well? Our staff is all wearing masks. So, you know, it's definitely going to be different, and we won't be packing 1,000 people into the building anymore for our speaker series, but we'll still have people here. And I think in some ways I feel really hopeful that our ability to adapt to this is just making us more resilient and making us more thoughtful about, you know, how we interact with one another in general. And hopefully we're learning how to be more compassionate and considerate of each other too through these trying times.
Well, the 10th anniversary of the Zappa Bus.
We're three years late in welcoming you. Hope you'll come back and join us. Thanks for everything that you are doing at the Pratt. Thanks for everything you're doing for Baltimore City. It really is one of the city's great institutions.
Thank you.
CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library, Heidi Daniel, our guest. We want to give a shout out and thanks to all of our WNST and Baltimore Positive sponsors, including our friends at Taharka Ice Cream. I'm holding up the Honey Graham here, but don't sleep on the Mint Flicks and chills with the mint as well. But I prefer the Honey Graham. I've actually got some leftover eggnog I've been eating this week as well. We're going to get out to State Fair in Catonsville and give them some love. Evan Brown, he will be joining us this week to talk about El Guapo, the new Mexican restaurant he's opening on Frederick Road in Catonsville, as well as our friends at Fadley's. You get out the Fadley's crab cakes. You can, it says order right here on the website. You click, you can deliver those Fadley's crab cakes to yourself or give them as a gift for the 4th of July as I wear my red, white, and blue, and you can check out the crab video as well. Don't forget our friends at Moeller and Gary Realty as well. That's 410-489-2621. You can find them online at MoellerandGary.com. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller and all that we're doing around here at Baltimore Positive, we are WNST.net, AM 1570, and Towson, Baltimore. Local, always calm, and always Baltimore Positive.